one said a word, but there was the sound of sobbing from several parts of the auditorium. The young man spoke again, and Parker translated.
That was an example of what you must not do from now on, and an illustration of what will happen if you disobey us.
He went on in the same style. Malcolm put his hand on Parker's sleeve. He'd heard enough. He whispered,
"Where does the stage door open?"
"Into an alley on the right of the main building."
"Is there another way out of the alley, or is it a dead end?"
"The only way out goes past the front of the theatre."
The gunman finished his speech and had given another instruction.
"Hostages," whispered Parker.
The remaining speakers on the stage were told to lie down on their faces with their hands behind their heads. One or two of them were old, or hampered by arthritis. The gunmen forced them down anyway. Then, at another order, the six men by the exit stepped forward, and each indicated to the nearest audience member that he or she should stand up and go with him. The woman sitting in front of Malcolm began to do that, but Malcolm stood up first. He turned to the gunman and pointed to himself. The gunman shrugged, and the woman in the seat behind sat down heavily.
"What are you doing?"
said Parker.
"Wait and see."
Malcolm stepped out into the aisle and put his hands up as the gunman indicated. Other hostages, two of them women, were doing the same and being ordered down towards the stage. Malcolm watched and followed their example. He reached the stage with the rifle prodding his back. There were steps up on each side, and he climbed them as the others were doing. As the first woman had to step past the body of the old farmer, where a pool of blood was still slowly growing larger, her demon dog suddenly howled and refused to step in it. She tried to pick him up, but the gunman behind her pushed hard with his rifle, and she fell over into the blood herself. She cried out in horror, and another of the hostages helped her up and kept his arms around her as she sobbed and nearly fainted. Malcolm watched it with close interest. The young man in charge had made a bad mistake. He should have let his cat demon deal with the raven and avoided shooting altogether. The situation was getting more complicated every second, and the gunmen had no plan to deal with it. A death, hostages, a whole audience imprisoned. But now, with no one to hold them at gunpoint, all the intruders being on the stage guarding their hostages, at any moment someone would run to an exit and try to get out, and then there'd be a panicked scramble to leave in which anything could happen. Malcolm saw the young man looking at everything, calculating swiftly, working it all out, and then give a harsh few sentences of command. Three of the men who'd come from the auditorium turned back and covered the audience with their rifles. The other three gestured at the six hostages, including Malcolm, to follow the leader into the wings at stage left. Malcolm was sure that the leader was improvising, and that hostages had never been part of his plan, but he had to admit that the young man was forceful and decisive. If he was going to be stopped at all, it would have to be soon. And it was Malcolm who'd have to do it. He hadn't had many fights as a boy, because he was big and strong and most people liked him, and in the playground scuffles he was forced into, he'd found himself bound by a sense of chivalry and fairness. Oakley Street had got rid of that. And as soon as he stepped into the wings, there came a piece of outrageous luck. Oakley Street had taught him what to do about that, too. Use it at once, and don't wait. He found himself in a crowded confusion of long black curtains, which were swaying and releasing a thin shower of dust. And just ahead of him, holding the pistol, was the young man who'd shot the farmer, and he was about to sneeze. Seeing that, Malcolm shook the nearest curtain hard, and the dust fell more thickly. For no more than a couple of seconds, the curtains cut them off from everyone else, and as the young man opened his mouth and shook his head and blinked in the shower of dust, trying to hold back the sneeze, Malcolm kicked him very hard in the groin. The sneeze came at the same moment. Helpless, the man dropped the gun and uttered a stifled grunt. Malcolm stepped forward, seized the young man's hair with both hands, and smashed his head downwards, at the same time bringing his own knee up hard into his face. Then he let go with one hand, and grabbing the man's beard, slammed it sideways while pulling his hair the other way. There was a loud crack, and the gunman's demon vanished before he hit the floor.
"This way," said Asta quietly, at the level of Malcolm's head. He saw she was clinging to a ladder, black-painted iron rungs set into the brickwork, and swung himself up silently, holding his breath, until he was above head height. His clothes were dark.
There was very little to see, even if anyone had looked in the right direction, and all around were the dark, hanging curtains, swaying in the confusion as the men and their hostages fumbled their way through. And Asta was up higher already, on a gantry, looking down through the steel-mesh floor at the doubt and confusion below, where some men had halted, some hostages were calling out in fear, and where the leader's body was lying, half-hidden by a curtain. A moment later, Malcolm was climbing the ladder again. He moved out onto the gantry and waited. Asta whispered, "What now?"
"They'll find his body in a minute." And
it was less than that. One of the gunmen fell over it, and called out first in surprise and annoyance, and then, when he realized what it was, in high alarm. Malcolm watched as the others responded in various ways. At first, none of them could see what had caused the alarm, and some called out to ask, while others, closer by, fumbled their way past the enveloping curtains, and almost fell over the body of their leader and the man who still lay sprawled in terror beside it. Complicating the scene were the hostages, who themselves were terrified and confused. One or two took immediate advantage of the distraction and fled further into the maze of curtains and darkness in the wings. Others clung together, too frightened to move, and that meant more blundering collisions and cries of alarm.
"They didn't plan this very well," said Asta.
"Neither did we."
The gunmen were now engaged in a desperate argument. There was no point in Malcolm's wishing that all the hostages would vanish into safety. Things were as they were. At some point, the gunmen would work out that the only person who could have killed their leader was the hostage who had disappeared. And then they'd begin to look for him. And then they'd find the ladder, and then they'd look up, and then they'd shoot him. But this was a gantry. It spanned the stage. Surely there'd be another ladder at the other end. And Asta darted away to look and come back. There was. A few moments later, Malcolm had climbed down and found himself in a similar black curtain space at stage right. And now what held him up was doubt. The one thing he must not do was make it more likely that innocent people would be shot. But how best to manage that? He might be able to find his way out of the building without being seen, but shouldn't he stay and try to find a way of saving them?
"Just go," Asta whispered. "Don't be foolhardy. We can't stop them if we can't argue with them and we can't speak their language. We can be much more use outside. How will it help Lyra for us to be shot dead in here? They'll do that as soon as they see you. Come on, Mal."
She was right. He moved towards the back wall. There must be a door in here somewhere. And there was. And it was unlocked. Turning the handle very carefully, he opened the door and stepped through before closing it again. Now he was in almost total darkness, but in the dim glow of an ambaric fire alarm, he could make out a narrow flight of stairs. Before going up, though, he looked back at the door, and sure enough, there was a bolt. He could hear the noise of arguing getting louder. Someone was shouting, and there were feet running on the stage. More voices joined in from the auditorium. He slid the bolt home with as little noise as possible. Asta looked at him from the foot of the stairs, thinking,
"No," he said. "There's another door, just along there."
He moved past the stairs and along a short corridor, seeing very little, but confident. Asta's eyes caught every photon there was to catch. The door had a push bar, not a handle, like a fire exit.
"These make a noise," said Malcolm. "I wonder if I can do it without banging."
Left hand on the vertical bolt, right hand on the bar. Stop and listen. There was a distant hubbub, but it was voices, not shots. He eased the bar inwards and felt the bolt slide down. A waft of cold air, laden with the smells of paint and turpentine and size, came out of the dark as he pushed the door open. There also came the sense of a large space with a high ceiling.
"Scenery painting," said Asta.
"That means there'll be a door to the outside for deliveries. Can you see it? A big door.
There's a bench right in front of you, a workbench. Go left a bit. That's it. Now, you can walk straight ahead. 5 more steps. Here's the back wall."
Malcolm felt the wall and moved along to the right. Almost at once, his hands found a large entrance closed with a roller shutter, and next to it a normal-sized door. It was locked.
"Mal," said Asta, "there's a key on a nail beside the door."
The key fitted the lock, and a moment later, they were outside the building and in a small yard open to the alley beyond. Malcolm listened carefully, but heard nothing more than the normal sounds of urban traffic. There was nothing unusual going on. No police cars, no crowds of people rushing out, no gunshots, no screams. They went out and turned right to bring themselves round to the theatre entrance.
"So far so good," said Asta.
The theatre foyer was glowing with light. It was empty. Malcolm supposed that the staff had all fled. He stepped inside and listened hard while Asta raced to the stairs and made for the dress circle. Malcolm could hear voices raised from the auditorium. Several voices, but not in anger or denunciation or pleading. They sounded like a large committee discussing a point of order. A minute went by, and Malcolm was about to move further in when a small shadow appeared from the staircase, and Asta jumped up on the box office counter to speak quietly.
"I can't make it out," she said. "The men with guns are on the stage, and they're arguing with some people from the audience. Farmers, maybe, hard to tell, but some women, too. And someone's found a rug and laid it over the body of the man they shot. And they brought the leader's body out on stage, too, and someone was tearing down a curtain to cover him with."
"What's the audience doing?"
"I couldn't see them clearly, but they're mostly still in their seats, and they seem to be listening. Oh, and Brian is there. On the stage, I mean. It looks as if he's taking minutes."
"No threatening, then? No guns?"
"They're holding their guns, but not pointing them at anyone."
"I wonder if I should go back in."
"Whatever for?"
That was a good question in the circumstances. There didn't seem to be much for him to do.
"Back to Calvi's, then," he said.
Calvi's was the bar where he'd arranged to meet Brian Parker earlier in the evening.
"Might as well," said Asta.
30 minutes later, Malcolm was sitting at a table with a glass of wine and a dish of grilled lamb, and as if they'd planned it, in came Parker. He pulled out a chair and beckoned a waiter.
"Well, what happened?" said Malcolm. "They were horribly baffled. They ushered the hostages back on the stage. We could see that something had gone wrong with their plans, but of course we had no idea what."
"I'll have the same as this gentleman," Parker said to the waiter, who nodded and left.
"What then?" "Then there was a stroke of good luck. It turned out that Enver Demerol was in the audience. Heard of him?"
"No."
"Conservative politician in the provincial assembly. Young, very bright. He stood up and called out, and that took some courage because the gunmen were very frightened, very jumpy, offering his help to moderate a discussion between all the parties. Well, that was where the rest of us realized for the first time that their leader wasn't there, because, the way he'd been speaking before, he wasn't one for discussions of any sort. Anyway, they accepted Demerol's offer, and I must say, I was never an admirer of his. He was superb. Calmed everything down, explained it all to the audience as he went along. And then we heard what had frightened the gunmen. Their leader had been killed. No one had seen it happen, and the killer had vanished."
"Extraordinary."
"Then I decided to join in. All good copy. I offered my services as secretary to the discussion. Demerol recognized me and urged the men to agree, which they did. Little by little, you see, moving the whole thing towards talk and away from violence."
"Clever."
"And cleverer still. The big mystery was, who had killed the leader? They found him in the wings with his neck broken. Had he fallen? Had he been attacked? If so, by whom? Well, there was no sign of anyone else around, and all the hostages were just as mystified as the gunmen, and just as frightened. That was the point when Demerol introduced the idea of divine justice. At least, let me get this right. He heard it in a remark from one of the hostages and skillfully tended it, not putting out any ideas himself, just allowing time for that notion to develop. The dead leader had been the one who killed the farmer. The retribution occurred so quickly that it seemed very likely to have a supernatural cause."
"Quite possibly."
"Then someone asked if all the hostages who'd come up were still there. There was a count, and a lot of complicated, yes he did, no he didn't, yes he was, no he wasn't, and in the end, they agreed that since every other explanation was impossible, it must have been the case that there had been an angel among the hostages, that he'd struck down the leader as punishment for shooting the farmer, and then vanished, probably flown back to heaven."
"No doubt.
Or to Calvi's."
"Improbable," said Malcolm blandly. The waiter brought Parker's food, and Malcolm asked for another bottle of wine.
"Anyway," Parker went on,
Demerol persuaded them to give up their guns into his charge, in exchange for which they could leave the theatre and disappear. A discussion about that, and then they agreed. So that's what they did. I must say, I've changed my view of that man. It was brilliantly done. He'd moved the atmosphere of the whole thing, the whole complicated situation, away from passion and towards rationality. And once they got there, it was just clear to everyone that even letting them get away without punishment would be better than a massacre. So, in the end, it was a fair outcome for everyone. Well, except the poor farmer, obviously. Quite. Brian, there was a phrase that young man used. The brotherhood of this holy purpose. Have you heard that before? Parker shook his head. New to me, he said. Why? It sounds just like the sort of slogan any of these fanatics might use. It probably is. Well, you kept your promise, anyway. What promise? To show me something interesting. Another glass? Chapter 27 The Café Antalya. The afternoon was far advanced. The sun had already set behind the mountains, and the air was cooling rapidly. Lyra had to move. She had to find somewhere to stay. She set off towards the centre of the city, past apartment buildings and office blocks and government ministries and banks. And soon the daylight was all gone, and the light she saw by came instead from naphtha lamps hung outside shops, or the more brilliant gas lights shining out from windows and open doors. The air was fragrant with the smells of grilling meat and spiced chickpeas, and Lyra realized that she was hungry. The first hotel she tried turned her down at once. The receptionist's look of superstitious horror made it clear why. The second place did the same, with fulsome expressions of regret and apology. They were small places, family-run, in quiet streets, not the large, glittering palaces that served statesmen and plutocrats and rich tourists. Perhaps she'd be better off in one of those, she thought, but shuddered at the expense. The third place she tried was more welcoming, simply by being less interested. The young woman at the desk was perfectly indifferent as Lyra signed the register and took her room key and turned back to her photo magazine at once. Only her dog demon seemed concerned and whined softly and hid behind her chair as Lyra passed. The room was small and shabby and overheated, but the light worked and the bed was clean and there was a little balcony overlooking the street. Lyra found that she could sit on a chair half in the room and half on the balcony and see along the street in both directions. She locked the room and went out briefly, coming back with a greaseproof paper bag containing grilled meat and peppers and some bread, and with a bottle of luridly coloured orange drink. She sat on the chair and ate and drank, finding little pleasure in the grisly meat and the sickly liquid, but thought grimly that at least she was keeping her strength up. The street below was narrow, but clean and well lit. On the side opposite her balcony was a café whose pavement tables were empty, but whose interior was crowded and bright. Shops to left and right sold hardware, or shoes, or newspapers and smoke leaf, or cheap clothes, or sweetmeats. It was busy. It looked as if everywhere was going to stay open long into the evening. People were slowly wandering along, or passing the time talking with friends, or sitting and smoking together beside a hookah, or haggling with shopkeepers. She fetched a blanket from the bed and put the light out and settled herself comfortably to watch everything. She wanted to see people and their demons. She felt hungry for their completeness. There was a stout man, short, bald, moustached, in a voluminous blue shirt, who had been standing in the doorway of his shop when Lyra began to watch, and who showed no sign of moving except to step out of the way when a customer wanted to go past. His demon was a monkey, with a bag of peanuts and a loud, cheerful voice, who carried on a raucous dialogue with him and with any of the friends who stopped to pass the time. There seemed to be plenty of them. Another fixture was a beggar who sat on the pavement with a kind of lute on his lap, occasionally playing a mournful snatch of melody for a few bars, before breaking off to call for alms. Another was a woman in a black headscarf, who was involved in a long discussion with two friends while their children squabbled and stole sweets from the stall behind them. Lyra watched. Their demons observed the owner without seeming to, and prompted the children, who struck like snakes when he turned away for a second. Their mothers were quite aware of this, and accepted sweets from the children's hands without breaking off their conversation. Occasionally a couple of policemen, guns at their waists, helmets low over their eyes, strolled along, looking at everything. People avoided returning their stare. Their demons, large and powerful dogs, stalked closely at their heels. Lyra thought about the princess's story. She wondered what the dancer's name had been, and if there was a picture of her anywhere in the archives of a Levantine newspaper. What was happening, anyway, when people fell in love? She'd heard enough about her friends' love affairs to know that demons complicated the matter, but deepened it too when it worked. Some girls seemed to be attracted to this boy or that, only for their demons to be indifferent, or even hostile. Sometimes it was the other way round, the demons passionately attracted, their people kept apart by dislike. And the princess's story had shown her yet another human possibility. Was it possible, though, as the old lady had said, for pretending to be in love to turn into actual love? She looked down at the street again, huddling the blanket up around her shoulders. The stout man in the blue shirt was now smoking a cheroot, passing it up to the monkey demon on his shoulder, and talking volubly to two other men whose demons were sharing a bag of nuts between them, cracking the shells in their teeth and throwing them into the gutter. The lute player had found another tune, and had even gathered an audience of two children who gazed at him hand in hand, the little boy nodding with his demon approximately in time with the rhythm. The woman with the sweet-stealing children had gone, and the sweetmeat seller was busy folding and stretching a hank of red-brown toffee. Gradually, as Lyra watched, she found her mood lifting. She'd hardly been aware of feeling anxious, but that was because anxiety was everywhere, built into the very molecules of the world, or so it had seemed. But now it was disappearing, like heavy grey clouds thinning and dispersing and finding their great banks of vapour drifting into wisps that wafted away into invisibility, leaving the sky clear and open. She felt her whole self, including the absent Pan, becoming light and free. Something good must have happened to him, she thought. And she found herself thinking about roses and dust. The street below her was saturated in dust. Human lives were generating it, being sustained and enriched by it. It made everything glow as if it was touched with gold. She could almost see it. It brought with it a mood that she hadn't felt for so long that it was unfamiliar, and welcomed it almost apprehensively. It was a quiet conviction, underlying every circumstance, that all was well, and that the world was her true home, as if there were great secret powers that would see her safe. She sat there for an hour, unconscious of the time, sustained by this new, strange mood, and then went to bed and fell instantly asleep. Pantalaimon was making his way south and east. That was all he could tell. For as long as he could, he stayed beside water, river, lake, or sea. It didn't matter which, as long as there was somewhere nearby to dive into and swim away. He avoided towns and villages. As he travelled through rougher and stranger country, he felt himself becoming wilder, as if he were really a Pine Marten, and not a human being. But he was a human being, or part of one, and he felt just as Lyra did, unhappy and guilty and wretchedly lonely. If he ever saw Lyra again, he would run towards her, and he imagined her bending to greet him, arms wide, and they'd both swear eternal love and promise never to part again, and it would all go back to the way it used to be. At the same time, he knew it wouldn't. But he had to hold on to something in the dark nights, and imagination was all he had. When he finally saw her, she was sitting in the shade of an olive tree on a hot afternoon, and she looked as if she was asleep. His heart leaped, and he bounded towards her. But of course it wasn't Lyra. It was a girl a few years younger, maybe 16 or so, with a shawl covering her hair, and a mixture of clothes that hadn't been hers, because they were a mixture of expensive and shabby, of new and old, of the too big and the too small. She looked exhausted. She looked hungry and dirty. She'd been weeping before she fell asleep, or maybe even during the sleep itself, because there were tears still on her cheeks. She looked as if she'd come from somewhere in North Africa, and she had no demon. Pan looked around very carefully and quietly, and looked at her from all sides, but he wasn't wrong. She was alone. Not even a demon as small as the smallest mouse was hiding near her, or curled up close by her head as it lay on a bank of dusty moss. She was in danger, then. He leaped up into the olive tree above her, perfectly silent, and climbed high until he could see all around. The blue gleam of the sea, the near white stone of the mountain on whose slopes the tree was growing, the dry green of the grass being cropped by a few skinny sheep. Sheep? So there might be a shepherd nearby. But Pan couldn't see anyone, shepherd or not. He and the girl seemed to be the only humans alive. Well, he could look after her, and pretend to be her demon, and guard her from suspicion at least. He climbed down and settled at her feet to doze. When she woke up soon afterwards, she sat up slowly and painfully, rubbing her eyes, and then, seeing Pan, jumped to her feet and backed away. She said something, but he couldn't understand it. She knew he was a demon, of course, and she was looking for his person, and she was terrified. He stood and bowed his head in greeting. "My name is Pantalaimon," he said clearly. "Can you speak English?" She understood. She looked around again, wide-eyed and sleepy still, as if it might have been a dream. "Where is your—" she said. "I don't know. I'm looking for her, and she's probably looking for me. Where's your demon?" "There was a shipwreck. A boat was sunk. I thought he must be dead, but he can't be because I'm alive, I think. Only I can't find him anywhere. What did you say your name was?" "Pantalaimon." "What's yours?" "Nur Huda el Wahhabi." She was still dizzy from tiredness. She sat down slowly. "This is too strange," she said. "Yes, it is. But I've had a bit longer to get used to it, maybe. We've been separated for... well, I can't remember, but it seems like a long time. When was your ship wrecked?" "Two nights. Three nights. I don't know. My family, my mother, my little sister, my grandmother, we were all in a boat, just a small boat, because of the men from the mountains. A big ship ran us down. We were all in the water, everyone, and the sailors in the big ship tried to save us, but some of us were carried away. I called and called until my throat was sore, and my demon wasn't with me, and I was so frightened. And everything was hurting, and in the dark, I couldn't see anyone, anything. And I was sure I would drown, and Jamal would die wherever he was. It was the worst thing I ever felt. But when the sun came up, I could see some mountains, so I tried to swim towards them. And finally there was a beach, and I swam there and just fell asleep on the sand. I had to hide from people when I woke up in case... you know." "Yes, of course you did. I suppose Lyra must be doing the same." "The name is Lyra?" "I had to steal things like these clothes. And food. I'm so hungry." "How did you come to speak English so well?" "My father is a diplomat. We lived in London for a while, when I was younger. Then he was sent to Baghdad. We were safe until the men from the mountains came. Lots of people had to flee, but my father had to stay. He sent us away." "Who are these men from the mountains?" "No one knows. They just come from the mountains and..." She shrugged. "People try and escape. They come to Europe, but where, I don't know. I would cry, but I've cried so much I haven't got any tears left.
I don't know if Mama is alive, or Papa, or Aisha, or Jida.
But you know your demon is alive?
Yes. Alive. Somewhere. We might find him. Have you heard of the Blue Hotel? Al-Khan al-Azraq? No. What is that?
It's a place where demons go. Demons without their people. I'm going there myself.
Why are you going there if your girl is somewhere else?
I don't know where else to go. Your demon might be there.
What did you call it? The Blue Khan.
Al-Khan al-Azraq. I think people are afraid of it.
It sounds like Moon Town. Moon City, maybe. I don't know what it would be in English.
Do you know where it is? He said, eagerly.
No. In the desert somewhere. When I went to school in Baghdad, the other kids used to talk about this place where there were night ghasts and ghouls and people with their heads chopped off, horrible things. So I was afraid of it. But then I thought it probably wasn't real, anyway.
Is it real?
I don't know. But I'm going to find it. Do you really think my demon could be there?
She reminded him of the Lyra of a few years ago, before their estrangement. Eager, curious, open-hearted, half-child still, but with a shadow of suffering on her.
Yes, I do, he said.
Could I?
Why don't we? They both spoke together and stopped. Then, I could pretend to be your demon, he said.
We could go there together. No one would know if we just behaved normally.
Really?
It would help me too. A lot. Honestly.
Some way off down the slope below them, someone was playing a reed pipe. A thin, musical knocking of bells followed it as the sheep began to move.
Let's do that then, said Nur Huda.
In the morning, Lyra remembered the mood of calmness and certainty like a dream, incomplete but still powerful. She hoped she could retain it for a long time and revisit it whenever she needed to. It was going to be a warm day. Spring was coming, and for some reason that made her think of one of the papers she'd found in the wallet of the murdered Dr. Hassel. It had been that brochure for a shipping line, listing the ports of call for a cruise on the SS Zenobia, among the ports being Smyrna. And someone had written the words, Café Antalya, Suleiman Square, 11 a.m. against the date of the ship's visit. That was several weeks away, but she could still go and look at the Café Antalya, and maybe have breakfast there. First she went out and bought some new clothes, a flowered skirt, a white shirt and some underclothes. Remembering the etiquette, she haggled the price down to what she felt was a respectable level. The shopkeeper was the man in the blue shirt, who was indifferent to her lack of a demon, though his own monkey demon jumped up to a shelf as far away as she could get. But Lyra managed to seem so calm and matter-of-fact that the monkey was merely disconcerted. Then she went back to the hotel and washed her hair, toweling it roughly dry and shaking her head to let it fall where it would. And then she put on the new clothes and paid her bill, and went out to find Suleiman Square. The air was fresh and clear. Lyra bought a tourist map of the city centre and walked the half mile or so to the square, which was shaded by trees just coming into leaf and overlooked by the statue of a lavishly medalled Turkish general. The Café Antalya was a quiet and old-fashioned place, with starched white tablecloths and dark wood panelling. It might have been the kind of place where a young woman on her own, let alone one without a demon, might have felt unwelcome. It had an air of old-fashioned masculine formality and style, but the elderly waiter showed her to a table with every courteous attention. She ordered coffee and pastries, and looked around at the other customers. Businessmen, perhaps. A father and mother with a young family. One or two older men dressed with fastidious elegance, one wearing a fez. There was one man on his own, writing busily in a notebook. And while she waited for her coffee, she played an Oakley Street sort of game, and watched him without looking directly. He wore a linen suit with a blue shirt and a green tie, and a Panama hat lay on the chair beside him. He was in his 40s or early 50s, fair-haired, slim, strong and active-looking. Perhaps he was a journalist. The waiter brought her coffee, a plate of elaborate pastries, and a little carafe of water. She thought, Pan would say I'd better eat no more than one of those. Across the cafe, the journalist was closing his notebook. Without looking, Lyra knew that his demon, a small white owl with large black-rimmed yellow eyes, was watching her. She sipped her coffee, which was intensely hot and sweet. The journalist stood up, put on his hat, and came straight towards her, making for the exit. But then he stopped in front of her, raised his hat, and said quietly, Miss Lyra Balakwa? She looked up, genuinely startled. The glare of the owl demon on his shoulder was ferocious, but the man's expression was friendly, puzzled, interested, a little concerned, but most of all surprised. His accent was New Danish.
Who are you? Said Lyra.
My name is Schlesinger, Bud Schlesinger. If I said the words, Oakley Street.
Lyra remembered Father Coram's voice, instructing her in his warm, tidy boat, and said,
If you said that, I'd have to say, Where is Oakley Street?
Oakley Street is not in Chelsea.
That's true as far as it goes.
It goes as far as the embankment.
So I've heard. Mr. Schlesinger, what on earth is going on?
They had been speaking very quietly.
May I join you for a moment? He said.
Please do.
His manner was free, informal, friendly. He was possibly even more taken aback by this encounter than she was.
What?
How? They both spoke at the same time, and were both still too surprised to laugh.
You first, she said.
Is it Balakwa or Silvertongue?
It was Balakwa. The other name is what I'm called now, among friends. But, oh, it's complicated.
How did you know about me?
You're in danger. I've been looking for you for over a week. There's been a general call for news of your whereabouts, that is, among Oakley Street agents, because the High Council of the Magisterium, you've heard about the new constitution, has ordered your arrest. Did you know about that?
She felt dizzy.
No, she said. First I've heard.
The last news we had of you was in Budapest. Someone saw you, but couldn't make contact. Then there was a report that you were in Constantinople, but that wasn't a definite sighting.
I've tried not to leave a trail. When? Why? What does the Magisterium want to arrest me for?
Blasphemy, among other things.
But that's not against the law.
Not in Britain. Well, not yet. This is not a matter of public knowledge. There isn't a price on your head, nothing of that sort. The council has let it be known discreetly that your arrest will be pleasing to the authority. The way these things work now, a word of that sort will be sufficient justification to make it happen.
How did you know who I was?
He produced a pocketbook and took out a printed photogram. It showed an enlargement of Lyra's face, taken from the matriculation photogram Lyra and her contemporaries had posed for in their first term at St. Sophia's.
There are hundreds of copies of this in circulation, he said, with the name Balakwa. I was kind of on the lookout, not because I expected you to come through Smyrna, but because I know Malcolm Polstead. And
you know Malcolm, she said. How?
I did my doctorate in Oxford. Oh, I guess 20 years ago. It was around the time of the Great Flood. That's when I first met him. But of course, he was just a kid then.
Do you know where he is?
What, right now? No, I don't. But he wrote me a short while ago, enclosing a letter for you, under the name Silvertongue. The letter's in the safe in my apartment. He said to look out for you.
A letter? Is your apartment nearby?
Not far. We'll go get it in a minute. Apparently Malcolm's on his way east. There's some big operation going on involving Central Asia, that's all he said. And we've heard something on the same lines from localized ears.
Yes, I think I know what that's about.
It involves a desert in Xinjiang, near Lop Nor, a place where, well, a place where demons can't go. Schlesinger's demon spoke.
Tungusk, she said.
Like that, said Lyra, but further south.
Tungusk?
Where the witches go, said Schlesinger.
Yes, but not that. Like it, but somewhere else. I can't help noticing, he said.
No, no one can help noticing.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. It's relevant. I can do what the witches do, and separate from my demon. But then he disappeared, my demon. And before I do anything else, I have to find him. So I'm going to a place called the Blue Hotel, or sometimes the City of the Moon, Madinat al-Kamar.
There's something familiar about that name. What is that place?
Oh, a story. Maybe just a traveler's tale. They say there's a ruined city there that's inhabited by demons. It might be nonsense, but I've got to try.
Oh, be careful, said the owl demon.
I don't know. Maybe they're ghosts and not demons. I don't even know where it is exactly. She pushed the plate of pastries towards him, and he took one.
Mr. Schlesinger, she went on, if you wanted to travel on the Silk Road to Sinkiang, to Lop Nor, how would you go about it?
You specifically want to go that way rather than, say, by rail to Muscovy and then through Siberia?
Yes, I want to go that way, because I think on the road I'd be able to hear a lot of news, gossip, stories, information.
And you're right about that. Well, your best bet is Aleppo. That's the western terminus, if I can put it like that, for one of the main routes. Join a caravan there and go as far as they'll take you. I can tell you the man to see.
Who's that?
His name is Mustafa Bey. The Bey is a courtesy title. He's a merchant. He doesn't travel much himself anymore, but he has interests in many ventures, caravans, cities, factories, enterprises, the whole length of the Silk Road. Now, it's not one road, but I guess you knew that. It's a whole bundle of trails and roadways and tracks. Some go south round a desert or a mountain range. Some go further north. Depends on what the caravan master decides.
And if I went to see this man, Mustafa Bey, would he be suspicious of me, of the way I am?
I don't think so. I don't know him very well, but I think he's interested almost entirely in profit. If you want to travel with one of his caravans, just show him you can pay.
Where can I find him? Is he well known there?
Oh, very well known. The best place to find him is in a cafe called Marletto's. He's there every morning.
Thank you. I'll remember that. Do you know why I came to this cafe today?
No. Why?
Lyra told him about the shipping brochure and the annotation marking the appointment in that very cafe.
It was found on the body of a man who just arrived in Oxford from Tashbilak, the place Oakley Street is interested in. He was a botanist, working with roses. We think that was why he was killed. But we've got no idea who was going to keep this appointment, him or someone else or both.
Schlesinger wrote a note in his diary. I'll make sure to be here on that date, he said.
Mr. Schlesinger, do you work full-time for Oakley Street?
No, I'm a diplomat, but I'm bound to Oakley Street by old ties of friendship. Besides actually believing in what they stand for. Smyrna is a kind of a crossroads. There are always things to watch or people to keep an eye on. And, once in a while, something to do. Now tell me what Oakley Street knows about your present situation. Do they know where you are? Do they know about your plan to visit this Blue Hotel if it exists?
She thought for a few moments. I don't know. There's a man called Coram Van Texel. Egyptian from the Fens, a retired Oakley Street agent who knows. He's an old friend, and I know he can be trusted. But in the light of day, I'm not sure about the Blue Hotel anyway. It all sounds so improbable. Secret Commonwealth business.
She used the phrase to see whether he'd heard it before, but he merely looked puzzled.
Now you've told me, I have to pass it on, he said.
I understand that. What's the best way of getting to Aleppo?
There's a good train service twice a week. One leaves tomorrow, I think. Listen, Miss Silvertongue, I really am anxious about your safety. You look too much like this picture. You ever thought of a disguise?
No, she said. I thought not having a demon might be a sort of disguise. People don't like looking at me because they're frightened or disgusted. They look away. I've been getting used to that, trying to be inconspicuous or invisible. Like the witches. It works some of the time.
Can I make a suggestion?
Of course. What?
My wife used to be on the stage. She's done this before a few times, changing someone's look. You know, nothing drastic, just a few details to help people's eyes see someone different from you. Would you come to my apartment with me now and let her help you? We'll pick up Malcolm's letter at the same time. Is she at home now? She's a journalist. She's working at home today.
Well, Lyra said, I think that might be a good idea.
Why did she trust this Bud Schlesinger? He knew about Oakley Street, and about Malcolm heading this way too, but an enemy might know those things and use them to trap her. It was partly her mood. The morning was sparkling. Things were intensely themselves. Even the Turkish general on the stone plinth had a roguish light in his eye. She felt she could trust the world. So 20 minutes later, she stepped out of the shuddering, creaking, ancient elevator in Schlesinger's apartment building and waited as he opened the door.
Excuse the lack of domestic airs and graces, he said.
It was certainly a place of color. On every wall hung rugs and other textiles. There were dozens of paintings and several walls of bookshelves. Schlesinger's wife, Anita, was colorful too. Slender and dark-haired and dressed in a scarlet smock and Persian slippers. Her demon was a squirrel. As Schlesinger explained the circumstances, she examined Lyra curiously, but it was a professional curiosity, full of life and understanding. Lyra sat on a large sofa and tried not to feel self-conscious.
Right, said Anita Schlesinger.
She too was New Danish, her accent a little less marked than her husband's.
Now, Lyra, I'm going to suggest 3 things. One is simple. You wear a pair of spectacles, plain glass. I've got some. The second thing is to cut your hair much shorter. And the third thing is to dye it. How do you feel about that?
Intrigued, said Lyra, carefully.
Would those things make a big difference?
Well, you're not trying to fool your friends or anyone who knows you well. It won't do that. What you're trying to do is make someone who's got a picture in his mind of a blondish girl without glasses not look at you twice. They'll be looking for someone who doesn't look like you. It's superficial, but superficial is the level most interactions work at.
Do they know you haven't got your demon with you?
I'm not sure about that, because that's a pretty big giveaway.
I know, but I've tried to make myself invisible.
Hey, I'd love to do that. You must tell me how. But first, can I cut your hair?
Yes, and dye it. I can understand the reason. All you said makes sense. Thank you.
Bud brought Lyra the letter from Malcolm, and then he had to leave. He shook Lyra's hand and said,
Seriously, you're in real danger. Don't forget that. It might be safer to stay in Smyrna till Mal gets here. We could keep you out of sight.
Thank you. I'll think hard about that.
Lyra was burning to read the letter, but she put it away for now and focused on Anita, who was keen to hear about the witches and their way of becoming invisible. Lyra told her everything she knew, and that led to Will, and how he'd worked the same sort of spell without knowing it. And that led somehow to Malcolm, and everything he'd told her about the flood, and how she'd never known about it when she was his pupil, and how differently she saw him now. It was the sort of conversation she hadn't had for a long time, and she had no idea how much she'd missed that sort of easy, friendly chatter. She thought, this woman would make an irresistible interrogator. No one could help telling her things. She wondered how often Anita had helped her husband with Oakley Street business. Meanwhile, Anita was cutting Lyra's hair, a very little at a time, stepping back and looking critically, checking in the mirror.
We're aiming to change the shape of your head, she said. That sounds alarming.
Without surgery, your hair is naturally wavy and thick and takes up a lot of space, even though it isn't very long. We just want to make it a bit self-effacing. The dye will make a bigger difference, but a lot of what you call being invisible depends on the way you hold yourself. I recognize that. I acted with Sylvia Martine once.
Really?
I saw a Lady Macbeth. Oh, terrifying. She could put it on at will. You know, I was walking down the street with her one day. We'd just been rehearsing, and it was a normal sort of busy city street, people going past, not noticing anything, and she said, you know, her name was really Eileen Butler. She said, let's call Sylvia. I didn't know what she meant,
But we'd been talking about audiences and fans and followers, and she said that, and I didn't know what to expect. Well, her demon was a cat, as you probably remember if you saw her on stage, a perfectly ordinary cat. But something happened to him then, or he did something, and instantly he became, well, I don't know how to put it, he became more visible, as if a spotlight had come on, focused right on him. And the same was true of her. One second she was Eileen Butler, you know, nice-looking, but just an ordinary passerby. The next second she was Sylvia Martin. Everyone in the street knew it. People saw her. They came up to speak. They crossed the street to ask for her autograph. And within a minute, she was pretty well surrounded. It happened outside a hotel. I think she knew exactly what would happen and did it somewhere where we could escape. The commissionaire let us in and kept everyone else back. Then she was Eileen Butler again. I wasn't a bad actress, but she was a star. And the difference is colossal, magical, something supernatural about it. I was too shy to ask how she did it, becoming Sylvia in that way. But her demon had something to do with it. He said very little. He just, I don't know, became more visible. Extraordinary. I believe it, said Lyra. I believe every word of it. I wonder if you can learn to do it, or whether it's only possible for a few people. I don't know. But I've often thought it would be dreadful to have that sort of power and not be able to turn it off. Sylvia could manage it. She was full of good sense. But in the case of someone vain or silly, it would drive them mad in the end, make them a monster. Well, I can think of a few stars like that. I want to do just the reverse. Can I see what it looks like now? Anita stood aside, and Lyra looked in the mirror. Her hair had never been so short. She liked it, liked the lightness, liked the air it gave her of being alert and bird-like. We've only just started, said Anita. Wait till you see it dyed. What color do you suggest? Well, dark, not hard black. That wouldn't go with your general coloring. A darkish chestnut brown. Lyra submitted willingly. In all her life, it had never occurred to her to have her hair colored. It was curious to find herself in the hands of someone so good at this whole business, so interested in it, so knowledgeable. They stopped partway through, and Anita made some lunch, just bread and cheese and dates and coffee, and told Lyra about her journalistic work. She was currently writing a piece for an English-language paper in Constantinople about the state of the Turkish theatre. Journalism sometimes overlapped with her husband's diplomatic work, and she'd seen something of the crisis in the world of rose gardens and precious oils and perfumery. She told Lyra about the numbers of gardens she knew about that had been destroyed, and of the merchants who dealt in those goods and who'd seen their factories and warehouses burned down. "It's happening much further east as well," she said, "as far as Kazakhstan, apparently. A kind of mania." Lyra told her about her friend Miriam, whose father had gone bankrupt. That was when I first heard about it. Only a few weeks ago. Oh, feels like a lifetime. Am I really going to be a brunette? Miriam wouldn't recognize me. She always wanted me to do more with my hair and so forth. Well, let's look, said Anita. Lunch cleared away. She took Lyra to the kitchen sink and unwrapped the towel from her head. I think that's worked very well, she said. Let me just... She ran her fingers through Lyra's hair, settled it slightly differently, stood back. A success, she said. Show me. Where's the mirror? It was a new face that looked back at her. Lyra's main thought, almost her only thought, was, would Pan like this? But at the back of her mind was another. As soon as Olivier Bonneville finds me again with the alethiometer, he'll know I look like this, and then so will the magisterium. Haven't quite finished yet, said Anita. Put these on. It was a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. Now Lyra was a different person altogether. You'll have to go on doing all that witch stuff about being invisible, Anita reminded her. That won't change. Dowdy. You need to be dowdy. Dull. Low-powered. You need dull clothes, not bright colors. And I'll tell you something else,
she added, brushing Lyra's new hair.
You'll have to hold yourself differently. You've naturally got a springy, active way of moving. Think yourself heavy, slow.
Then her demon spoke. He'd been watching all this, saying little, occasionally nodding with approval. But now he perched on the back of a chair and said directly,
Make your body heavy and slow, but don't forget what your mind's doing. You need to look like someone who's suffering from a depression of the spirits, because that makes people turn away. They don't like looking at suffering, but it's very easy to become depressed by mimicking it. Don't fall into that trap. Your demon would tell you that if he was here. Your body affects your mind. You need to act, not be.
That's it, said Anita. That's your note from Telemachus.
It's a very good one, said Lyra. Thank you. I'll do the reverse of what Eileen Butler did to become Sylvia Martine, but not in my mind.
What are you going to do now? Said Anita.
Buy a railway ticket for Aleppo. Go to the post office and see if there's a letter for me.
The Aleppo train leaves tomorrow. Where are you going to stay tonight?
Not in the same hotel. I'll find another one.
You certainly won't. You'll stay here tonight. Anyway, those glasses need adjusting. They keep sliding down your nose.
Are you sure? I mean, about me staying?
Yes. I know Bud will want to hear more from you.
Then, thank you.
The spectacles adjusted, Lyra went out in her new persona. She bought a dull brown skirt and as dowdy a sweater as she could find. She bought a ticket for the Aleppo train, and then she found a small cafe and ordered hot chocolatl. When it was on the table in front of her, a mound of whipped cream slowly subsiding into the liquid, she looked at her name on the envelope in his clear hand. It wasn't one of the heavy college envelopes, but a flimsy one of coarse, yellowing paper, and it bore a Bulgarian stamp. How absurd to find her hands shaking as she tore it open.
Dear Lyra, I wish you'd keep still so I could catch up with you. This part of the world is becoming more unstable by the day, and the kinds of thing I can say in a letter are getting fewer and fewer the more likely it is that the letter will have been opened before it reaches you. If you come across an Oakley Street friend in Smyrna, you can rely on him with total confidence. Actually, if you're reading this letter, you know that already. You're now being watched and followed, but you probably haven't noticed yet, and those who are watching now know that you've been warned about it. I understand your reason for taking the route you've chosen, and why you want to travel through that particular region. I shall search for you there, if our paths don't cross beforehand. There's a lot I'd like to say to you, but nothing I want to share with the other eyes that will read this letter. I've learned a number of things I want to talk to you about. Matters of philosophy, not least. I want to hear about everything you've seen and felt. I hope with every fiber of my being that you're safe. Remember everything Coram told you, and keep watchful. With the warmest of wishes, Malcolm. Lyra had seldom been so frustrated. All those general warnings. And yet he was right. She looked carefully at the envelope again, and saw that the flap had been stuck down twice, the second time not quite over the first. When she wrote back, which she'd do as soon as she had paper and a pen, she'd have to write in exactly the same terms to Malcolm. She read the letter through again, twice, and then drank her cooling chocolatl, and walked, carefully, dowdily, aware of everything around, back to the Schlesinger's apartment. But before she even turned the corner into the quiet street where their building stood, she heard the sound of sirens, and the harsh engines of police cars or fire appliances, and she saw above the rooftops a plume of dirty smoke rising into the air. People were running. The engines and the sirens came closer. She went to the corner of the street and looked round. It was the Schlesinger's building, and it was ablaze. Chapter 28 The Miriorama. Lyra turned away from the blazing building at once,
and walked steadily, dowdily, heavily, towards the centre of the city. Her mind carried on half of a dialogue with Pan, urgent and frightened, but none of it showed on her face or in her bearing.
I should stop. I should find out if they're safe. I know I can't. It would only make it worse for them, apart from anything else. It's because of me that it happened. Whoever set the fire is probably watching to see if anyone runs out, or... I'll write to them as soon as... I can't stay here in Smyrna now. Gotta get out as soon as possible. Who am I? What was my witch name? Tatiana. And a patronymic, Tatiana Azrielovna. Oh, maybe that gives too much away. Giorgio. Georgiovna. If only I had a passport in that name. But witches don't need passports. I'm a witch. A witch disguising herself as a... Oh, what was it? Dowdy girl. Yeah, depressed and dowdy. Just so people don't look at me. Oh, God, I hope Anita and Bud are all right. Perhaps he's still at his office and doesn't know about it. I could go and tell him. But I don't know where that is. I must be Oakley Street-ish about this. If it was intended for me, then I'd be dangerous for them. What should I do? Get away. But the train doesn't leave till... Oh, get another train. Where's the next train stop? No trains for Aleppo. There's one for a place called Seleucia. Agrippa mentioned that. Go there today and... The Blue Hotel. The City of the Moon. Between Seleucia and Aleppo. That's what I'll do. Maybe first find somewhere quiet and try the new method again. People get their sea legs and then they stop feeling seasick. Perhaps I could try that. And get together with Malcolm. Yes! But I don't know where he is. Well, a letter was posted in Bulgaria, but he could be anywhere now. He could have been arrested. In prison. He could be dead. Oh, no, don't think like that. Oh, Pan, if you're not at the Blue Hotel, I don't know if I can go any further. Why do demons go there? But I've got the princess's list of names in Aleppo, and that merchant there, Bud Schlesinger, told me about this morning. What was his name? Mustafa Bey. Oh, this is horrible. Danger all around. People who want to kill me. Even the Master of Jordan only wanted to put me in a smaller room, not kill me. I wonder how Alice is now. Pan, we might not like each other much, but at least we're on the same side. And if they kill me, then you... You won't survive in the Blue Hotel or anywhere else. Self-preservation, Pan, if only for that. Why did you go there? Why there? Did someone kidnap you? Is it a kind of prison camp? Will I have to rescue you? Who's keeping you captive? The secret Commonwealth will have to help. If I get there. If I find Pan. If...
The one-sided conversation sustained her for part of the way to the station. It was so hard to make herself move slowly, though, to be dull and depressed. Every particle of her body wanted to run, to dart across the squares and open spaces, to look all around every second, and she had to keep a firm hold on the image she wanted to project. Being invisible was hard work, and unrewarding, soul-crushing work. No one had told her that. She was passing through a district where a number of temporary camps had been set up for the people displaced from their homes further east. In the next few days, perhaps, these people would be trying to find a passage across the sea to Greece, and perhaps some of them would suffer shipwreck and drown. Children were running about on the stony ground. Fathers stood in groups talking, or sat smoking in the dust. Mothers washed clothes in galvanized buckets, or cooked over open fires. And there was a barrier that was invisible and intangible between them and the citizens of Smyrna, because they had no homes. They were like people without demons, people missing something essential. Lyra wanted to stop and ask them about their lives and what had brought them to this state of things, but she had to be invisible, or at least forgettable. Some of the young men glanced at her, but not for long. She felt their flickering attention like the touch of a snake's tongue, and then it withdrew. She was successfully uninteresting. At the railway station, she tried one counter after another until she found someone who could speak French, which she thought would be safer than English. The train for Seleucia was a slow one, stopping at what seemed like every station on the way, but that suited her. She bought a ticket and waited on the platform in the late afternoon sun, hoping she was transparent. There was an hour and a half to wait. She found an empty bench near the cafeteria, and she sat there and kept watch all around while trying to seem invisible. She had one shock as she came to the bench and saw her reflection in the cafe window.
Who was this dark-haired stranger in glasses? Thank you, Anita, she thought.
She bought some food and drink for the journey and sat on the bench. She couldn't stop her thoughts circling back to the Schlesinger's apartment building. If Anita hadn't spotted the fire soon enough, if she hadn't managed to get out. Thoughts that didn't bear thinking kept crowding in and shouldering aside her pretended passivity. A train came in and disgorged a platform full of travellers. Among them were several families who looked only a little better off than the people she'd seen in the camp and on the streets. Mothers in heavy clothing and headscarves. Children carrying toys or torn shopping bags, or sometimes younger brothers or sisters. Old men harassed and exhausted, carrying suitcases or even cardboard boxes containing clothes. She remembered the riverboat docking in Prague, and the refugees getting off. Would any